very, very glad to introduce my good friend Christian. You more about his work in his book, but basically he's one of the leader of the social brain, of studying the social brain in more general social science. And he was from the original group in Parma that discovered the mirror neurons and then extended it to relate this idea of mirroring to emotion and sensations. We know each other for a few years. And I think Christian is not stating himself as an improviser, but I would say he's a closet improviser. He's one of the funniest person I know, has this unique ability to really be in the here and now and respond to what's going on, and also to stay, I would say, calm in very stormy moments. He's studying empathy, and some of you might know those scientists who study color, but they are colorblind. This is definitely not the case. He's a very empathic person, and in particular, he was very empathic to me recently in some of my shortcomings, so thanks, Christian, for this. And without further ado, I want to introduce my good friend, Christian Kaisers.
Thank you. I should say that very much in the theme of the conference, I'm actually a team. My wife and I work together, and Valeria will be talking on Friday. And we have kids as well, so basically early this afternoon, I'll have to leave, but she comes in, and she can completely replace me. So you'll have one of us all the time with you. Now, I'm really thankful for being here and for this nice introduction. And I'm realizing that we are a very, very multidisciplinary group. So I'd like to invite you during the talk as well to just interrupt me if there are things that are unclear. It'd be really a shame if kind of some of you just would get glazy eyes and wouldn't understand quite what I'm saying. And it doesn't matter if I don't get to the end of the talk. Now, as Leo said, actually, what really interests me is how we understand other people. How is it that we simply look at each other's faces often just for a second or two and get these very detailed insights into what is going on in other people? Now, I often like to take Hollywood movies as an example as well of this kind of capacity. So if you look at this little clip from the James Bond movie, Dr. No, I could ask you what you're seeing, and you could tell me, gee, I love this movie because there's a pixel here flickering at 0.3 hertz. But if you would, I would probably try to include you into one of our autism studies because that's not what most of you should be seeing. Most of you should be seeing a scared secret agent that's trying to get rid of a spider. Now, the mystery in that is that things like intention, trying to get rid of a spider, or things like fear, happen inside of his brain. Now, there's no way that you can directly see his brain. All you see is the flashing of the pixels. But somehow, your brain makes you stop to see what you can really see, which is the flickering of the pixels, and you start to see what you cannot possibly see, which is what is actually going on in the brain of this person. And then, to really understand that there's different aspects. There's aspects related to sensations and emotions, and Valeria will talk more about that aspect later on in the conference. I'm going to concentrate more on the action aspect, how you understand the actions of the person, and how this, to some extent as well, contagious your own motor system. Why is it that when you see a movie like that, you're a bit tense yourself as well, and you're preparing to act yourself? Now, to do that, there'll be four items on the menu. We'll start with a very short introduction to the mirror neuron system. Then I'll go into the question, basically, of how it is that we learn to map the actions of others onto our own actions, and what that may tell us about how we can actually interact in real time with other people. And then I'll have two sections in which I'll try to use what I call a brain-to-brain approach, which is a different way to look at neuroscience data to allow us to really look at much more complex stimuli and more complex interactions and try to understand what really unfolds in the brain. Now, let's start with
What we know actually happens in your brain while you see the actions of other people. Well, a lot of what we know about that doesn't come from the study of humans, but from work we've done in monkeys. And the reason is that in the monkey, you can introduce microelectrodes into certain parts of the brain. And once you have implanted them, you can freely interact with the monkey while you can listen to what individual neurons are doing in the brain. And for neuroscientists, it's really exciting because you get to get really the activity of the real players in the brain while you can engage in complex interactions. And if you do that in the premotor cortex of the monkey, so the eyes would be here, this is where your primary motor cortex is that directly controls your body. This is a higher order motor region that controls more complex actions. Now, if you put an electrode in there, the first thing you'll notice is that all of the neurons in that region are involved in making the monkey do stuff. And that what I'm going to show you here very briefly is a little movie of the monkey grasping a piece of apple. And you're going to hear the firing of one of the neurons while the monkey is grasping. It worked a second ago. Do you know if we need to turn on the audio separately? Yes, it is. And I tried it a second ago. It was working. Otherwise, I can always improvise and just try to do the soundtrack myself. Why don't we do that part?
Well, we could just hear it from the computer.
Yes, I can try that as well.
Okay. This is sound or this is just static noise?
That is, my computer is not connected right now. So let's see if we can get this to work again. And now it has crashed the whole computer. Let me see what's going on here. Interesting. Whoa. Let's see. Now we've really lost the whole thing. Here. Yes, okay, now it's on the computer. Let's try to see. Yes, okay. But now you don't see it. This is great. No, exactly. Let's see it once more. Yes, easy enough. So, that part is not very exciting. We knew that for a long time, that this part of the brain controls the monkey's own action. The real surprise came from finding that about 10% of these neurons that were supposed to only control the monkey's own action as well become active when the monkey sees somebody else do the exact same thing. So this neuron is responding during grasping when the monkey does it. And in the next movie, hopefully, you'll see how the same neuron responds as well while the monkey sees one of us perform grasping actions with our mouth or with our hands. This is the monkey grasping. This is Leo grasping with his mouth. And this is Leo grasping with his hand. And here grasping again. So from just that, you might figure maybe the neuron responds to everything and it isn't very interesting. But that's not the case. So if you do something that visually is very similar at low level, bringing it to the shoulder, you don't get the response. Whereas if you bring it to your mouth, which is grasping, you do. That's what you would see in the last movie. This works. This doesn't. This works again. Now, what was really fundamental about this observation is that up to that point, people assumed that when you see what other people do, this gets processed in visual centers of your brain, and then maybe you think about it. What this actually showed is that you have motor representations of your own actions in the brain. And you see that in particular because if you stimulate this neuron through an electrical current instead of recording, you would see that the monkey will start to grasp things around him. So it's really the motor program. But whenever the monkey sees somebody else do a similar action, the brain seems to translate what the monkey sees into what it would actually take to do the same action yourself. So in a way, the monkey stops to just see what others do and start to basically embody it into his own body. Now, of course, most of you are not really interested in monkeys, so one of the questions is whether humans have a similar system. And the other thing is that, of course, this single neuron doesn't do it alone. We want to get an idea of the whole network that is doing this in the brain. So in humans, it's difficult to find people that don't mind you drilling a hole in their skull to put an electrode in. So we have to come up with alternative methods. And so what we do here, for instance, is we put someone in a scanner, we measure brain activity, and we ask them to do relatively simple everyday actions like scooping soup out of a bowl or grasping and some pretending to drink from a glass. And if you do that, you can, in each individual subject, this is just one subject here, map all of the parts of the brain in red that are involved in actually doing such an action. And then we can as well show the person somebody else performing similar actions, and we subtract brain activity that's just due to seeing objects in hands or a kind of aimless motion. What you get is then for the same subject this blue pattern. And it becomes interesting when you put the two patterns together and the color kind of the things that are in common in white, and I choose the colors here because we're in France. And that what you see is that basically there are parts of the human brain as well that are similarly active whether you do something or whether you see somebody else do similar things. So in a way, we as well will internally embody the actions that we see other people do. What you might notice is though that there are some parts that are involved when you perform an action here in red that are not common with the observation. And that includes the primary motor cortex, which is the part that is directly controlling your body. So what this means is that while you're seeing me in talk and gesture, in a way, in a higher level of your motor system, you will share my actions, but you will not necessarily move your body all the time with me, kind of mirroring my actions, because you suppress the activity in the direct output stages of your brain. Now, if we put that back into the brain, what we basically see is that while we witness a social stimulus, like the actions of other people, this initially gets processed in auditory and visual areas of your brain. But it doesn't stop there. It will go on to activate parts of your parietal and somatosensory cortex and parts of your premotor cortex as if you'd be doing similar actions. And if you want to, you can then use this activity to actually perform overtly actions that are very similar to those of the other person. So you can, in a way, directly and overtly imitate what other people are doing because your brain permanently maps what you observe into the motor format that would be necessary to imitate that. But sometimes you don't actually want to imitate overtly, but you'll still get some traces of that. So for instance, my grandfather was a huge soccer fan. Whenever he'd see his favorite player and kick a goal, he'd be kicking the table in front of him. And back then I thought it was a really silly thing to do, in particular because he actually had a wooden leg. So it made a huge noise on this little table. But now kind of 30 years later, I start to understand that basically, although normally this activity is sub-threshold, when you very strongly identify with someone, you'll start to get this activity to be so strong that a part of it will sweep into your body. But this isn't just true for my grandfather. So a primatologist friend of mine, Andy Whiten, was observing chimpanzees that are learning new skills. So what happened is they gave the chimpanzees nuts that are very, very hard to crack. So there's no way you can crack them with your teeth. And this guy here has found out that you can use a big stone as an anvil to actually break these nuts. And this little guy here really likes nuts as well and would like to get some, but he doesn't know how to do it yet. But he's observing the other guy, and I'd like you to observe what he's doing with his hand, although he doesn't have a nut or anything, while he's observing the other one performing the action. You see, very nice mirroring there for a while. Afterwards, he starts to get more interested in a different pair of nuts, which is very frequent behavior in chimpanzees as well. But for a while, you could see as well how in this animal, what is normally a covert simulation of what other people do can become overt and observable. Now, one of the big questions we have, of course, is how is it that we actually, in our brain, activate the motor system when we see the actions of others? If you think about it from a physical point of view, there's really nothing in common between seeing an action, which is photons entering your eyes, and performing the action, which is activity in your muscle fibers. So how is it that the brain actually learns to map these two very different spaces onto each other? And then what I'm going to present here is a model of how Hebbian learning can help you understand how this might happen. And I'm going to start by telling you briefly what Hebbian learning actually is. Then I'm going to start from a very kind of helicopter view, what that would mean at a macro-temporal scale. And then we're going to go a bit more into the details of fine temporal scales, which will give us anticipations, which are very interesting for joint actions, I think. So what is Hebbian learning? Well, Hebbian learning was an idea of somebody that I really consider a genius, Donald Hebb. He was living and working in the 40s, back when we didn't really have much technology to observe really what happens in neurons or in synapses. But he was really fascinated by how we develop memories. And he figured, he knew about neurons, in that neurons are connected by synapses. And he figured, well, could we come up with a simple rule of how the brain could learn new things? And he came up with this rule that is as follows. So he speaks of two neurons, A and B, that are connected through axons and synapses here at the contact. And he says, when an axon of cell A is near enough to excite the cell B and repeatedly or persistently takes part in firing it, some growth process or metabolic change takes place in one or both, such that A's efficiency as one of the cells firing B is increased. What he basically says, if A often triggers activity in cell B, then the connections become thicker. There is another rule that says that if they repeatedly don't fire together, these connections get thinner again. Now, this has sometimes been paraphrased as what fires together wires together, which is very elegant as a phrase, but completely wrong, because if two things exactly fire together, one couldn't have taken part in firing the other one. So please don't use this paraphrase as much as you can. But the nice thing is, he had this idea in the 40s, and it took 60 years to actually have the technology to check whether that's true. Because to really check this, you have to be able to record simultaneously from two neurons that are connected. And people have done that 60 years later, and found that basically the temporal interval in which these two neurons fire is critical. If this one fires about 10 milliseconds before the other, which is the interval that would allow A to actually trigger activity in B, you have strong synaptic increase in the connection. If the cell fires a little bit afterwards, there is actually strong depression. So it really then selects true causal temporal connections between neurons. Okay, but what does that mean for how we can map the actions of others onto our own? Well, imagine that we have here a little baby, and the little baby has two sets of neurons in its motor system. The red one make baby grasp, the yellow one make baby throw something away. Well, what happens if baby activates in the red one, the grasping one? Well, baby will grasp something in front of him. And who of you have kids? You probably notice that while a baby grasps things for the first times, they're incredibly attentive at what they're doing. They really stare at their own hands with great interest, which means that while baby is grasping, baby actually stares at himself grasping. And this is my baby grasping for the second time. And considering that this is a piece of jewelry, I'll let you guess whether it's a boy or a girl. But what happens is that the motor action that that she tries out will get into her visual system. And you'll have some neurons that happen to respond to grasping in there. But I think that initially, there's weak and random connections between the visual system and the motor system. We need these connections because, of course, you need to guide your action through the visual system. So you have them in place. But if we now remember Hab's learning rule, and I let you guess what happens at these synapses. So these synapses between grasping motor neurons and the site of grasping would systematically be coactive. At the same time, babies don't typically throw something while they're at the same time watch themselves grasping. So these ones will be actually anti-correlated. So what will happen just by observing yourself is that you're going to be reinforcing those connections that are actually congruent between what you do and then and what it looks like to do these actions. So if you do that for a couple of times, you'll now have a system where if you see somebody else grasp, you'll actually start to trigger your own matching motor system. And this doesn't need to be pre-wired at all. Yes? Oh, you were just pointing to the sky. So this allows you to learn these connections. Well, this is a hypothesis. Does it actually work? So one way you can test this is by taking motor skills that people have never performed themselves. And a lot of people have never played the piano. So you can take them, put them in a scanner, and play them the sound of a very simple electronic piano melody, something like this. And if you do that with a piano naive person, you'll only measure activity in sensory cortices here in the auditory cortex. The melody is so simple because you can now basically teach them in 5 hours to play this simple melody themselves. And during the training, what they'll experience is how each motor act actually sounds like. So they're in an ideal situation to wire up their brain in this kind of Hebbian way. Now, if you do that and scan them again after 5 hours, you'll start to get motor activity in them to the sound of that piano melody. So just 5 hours of learning to play the piano suffice for them to stop to just listen to piano with their ears and to start to listen to piano with their fingers as well, which is really evidence that we can even as adults wire this up very nicely. But what happens if we look at more fine details of this? Well, if you think about a single action like grasping an object, there's actually multiple phases to it, right? You have to reach for the object, and then you have to grasp for it later on. And if you think about these details, if you think about me reaching, I need to program reaching in my brain. Then it's going to take about 100 milliseconds for it to actually start moving my body. And then it takes another 1 to 200 milliseconds to be actually processed in my visual system and sent onwards to the motor system. By that time, I'm actually stopping to reach already and I'm actually grasping the object. So that at this point, I'll start to activate the following action motorically, which is grasping. And now if you think in more detail at what happens at these synapses, the synapses that should get reinforced are not actually the ones from reaching to reaching, but the one from reaching to grasping. Because this is where you really have the right kind of Hebbian temporal learning aspects. What this means is that Hebbian learning actually doesn't create just simple mirror neurons. It will actually wire a certain form of predictions so that whenever you see reaching, you'll actually activate a motor program for the following action, which is grasping. Now, how is that useful? So we'll make a little experiment here where I'm going to play you the sound of clapping, and I want you to clap along with the sound. So get your hands ready. Okay, here you go. You're not very good at this, are you?
So,
exactly. So let's do this again, but this time I'll do the clapping and you follow me. Much better, aren't you? Why are you so much better? Because you can actually use the visual information from my preceding actions to automatically anticipate. And it is this anticipation that actually then gives you the time to program your own clapping and finally clap in approximate synchrony. So we think that what is nice about this is that you have a very simple learning rule that is plausible at a synaptic level, but that gets you the kind of predictions that you need to be able to actually act jointly with other people. Now, if you... I'll skip some of this in the interest of time. Now, do we have any evidence in the brain, again, that we actually engage in these kind of predictions in the sensory motor pathway? Well, one way we can look at it is by taking some of the firing activity we had in the monkeys. So here you see a motor neuron that responds when the monkey himself breaks a peanut. But not when the monkey does something else, like grasping a little squeaking duck. And then what you can do is you can stand in front of the monkey and play back the sound of these two actions, so the cracking of a peanut or the squeaking of a little duck. And the sound starts at this gray bar, and what you see is that the neuron still reflects the activity for the same preferred action, but it lags behind the actual sound. The firing takes about 100 milliseconds to go online. If, on the other hand, you stand in front of the monkey and you take the peanut and you break it, then you'll see that the activity will actually start to ramp up before the actual cracking occurs, doing away with the delays in this system. But we tried as well to do an fMRI experiment to try to see whether indeed our motor system starts to represent these chains of individual actions. Now, in theory, it would be a simple experiment to do, right? If the system really just represents individual acts like grasping, if you take a complex chain like eating peanuts, you'd have some neurons responding to reaching and grasping, some to breaking the peanut, and others to bringing it to your mouth, for instance. If you really have chains being represented in the system, you would assume that some systems are as well representing these transitional probabilities. So you could make a simple experiment in which you film some complex actions. And here what you see is the actor, for instance, unpacking her glasses, realizing that the glasses are dirty, then figuring, oh, I need to clean them. So she's going to take some conveniently located wipes for her glasses. She'll open it. The whole thing takes a minute, so I'm not going to bore you through all of it. But what is kind of boring about it is that you can really predict a lot of things in there. And we could take this movie, of course, and chop it apart and rearrange the order of the actual elements, which would give you something like this, where now you cannot predict anymore what comes up next. And you could compare brain activity between those two. If you would do that, it wouldn't be a very fair comparison because this keeps jerking and flashing. This one is nice and smooth. So what we do is we use a director's trick, which is to actually film the action from two cameras, from two slightly different angles. And now what we can do is we can create an intact version in which we just switch perspective from one act to the other, but the flow is still makes sense. Or we can rearrange them randomly, and now you have the same jerkiness, but in one you can predict, you can do all those nice things, and the other one you can't. So now we can put people in an fMRI scanner, measure what happens during those two movies, and we can look where in the brain it really makes a difference. The only problem is that the traditional way in which people analyze fMRI data is that they have a hypothesis of how activity in brain regions that do the task should go up and down over time. And then they look for brain regions that do that. But in a movie like this that lasts for a minute, I'm wondering who of you could draw me the time course that the neurons should have to be doing interesting things. And the answer is none of you actually could draw this time course, because we know that if you present movies like those to the brain, different brain regions have very different time courses. Although they're triggered by the movie, they have very different time courses. So that this traditional approach of, oh, I know what the brain should be doing, and now I'm going to find where it's doing it, this doesn't work if you have complex stimuli. So what else could you do? Well, together with Uri Hasson, because we're very humble people, we figured we're going to bring in a Copernican revolution into this thing. And why do we speak of something as bold as Copernican revolution? Well, if you think about pre-Copernican times, you had incredibly smart astrologists and astrophysicists trying to map the orbits of the planets in our system. And because they were smart, they did manage to map them. But if you look at the orbit of planets, if you see the Earth as the center of the universe, these orbits are very complex. It's a very hard problem. And then Copernicus came along, and he figured, well, let's try by putting the sun in the center of our system. And now the same orbits become very simple to describe. Now, none of them is more accurate than the other. It's just that by changing the reference frame, your task becomes easier. And this is what we think we can do in the brain as well, by going from a framework where you start by analyzing the stimulus, you say, I know what the time course should be, and you look for it to the brain, to a different approach, in which we completely forget the stimulus per se, and we figure what we're going to do is we're going to take the brain activity of the other people as my hypothesis for what brain activity should be in the same place in an other individual. Now, I'm going to explain this in very simple ways. Now, imagine you're in a part of the brain that is completely blind to the stimulus that you're showing to 20 individuals. If this part of the brain is completely blind to what is happening in the stimulus, and you show the stimulus to 20 people, how similar should the brain activity be in those 20 individuals? Who has a hypothesis of how high the correlation should be? Low? Indeed. It should actually be very close to zero. There will be spontaneous activity in that part of the brain, but because it's not triggered by the stimulus, it's not going to synchronize. Now, what would happen if you'd be in a part of the brain that's entirely determined by the stimulus? How similar should now the activity be across individuals? High. Ideally one, but you have measurement, noise, and all of that. So what is important here is that I'm not actually interested in synchrony between the different brains because they just see the same movie. There's nothing social happening. But what is interesting is that I can take the correlation between their brain activity as a proxy of how much this brain part actually represents the stimulus. Now, if you do that with our kind of stimuli, what I'm plotting now is what I see these intact sequences, how much different brain parts synchronize across individuals. And you see a map that's quite similar to what we've seen before with premotor and parietal and high-level visual areas. This is the same effect when you scramble the order of the sequences. What is important is that there's a difference between the two. And if you map the difference, you get this map here. So this is a map extracted from these complex stimuli that shows where in the brain you're actually representing the sequence of observed actions. And if you overlap that with the parts of the brain that were simply involved when you do and observe very simple acts, which is the mirror system here in green, you'll see that basically a lot of these areas shown in yellow will actually respond not just to simple acts, but to larger temporal scales of what other people do, allowing you to actually anticipate what they're doing. Now, because I run pretty much out of time, I'm gonna skip the part on communication that I would have had. That's what I was hoping for. Exactly. So I think what I really want you to take home from what I presented just about the action sequences is not just the details of the brain region. It's more the idea that we can actually be daring and take quite complex stimuli and really map brain regions that are responding to them. And now we can take the same logic to look at something that is more truly an improvised interaction. And so what we've done in an experiment is we had people come into the lab and we had them play the games of charades. Do people know what the game of charades is? You get a word, you have to mimic it to a partner and the partner has to guess. So what we did was we had romantic couples come in, so a boy and a girl that know each other very well. We take, for instance, the girl, we put her in the scanner while we're measuring her brain activity. We give her a word to gesture, like winding stairs, and she now has about a minute to gesture that into a video camera. So what you see here is her improvising gestures. In this case, it's kind of fingers walking up a winding stairs. She goes through 7 of these words, knowing that her boyfriend will later on have to guess what these words are. Then we kick her out of the scanner, we put the boyfriend into the scanner and have him watch these movies while we're recording his brain activity. He first has to watch for at least 30 seconds, and then whenever he thought that he really understands what the gesture is, he presses a button, gets a multiple choice, and has to choose, in this case, winding stairs. Now, people found this experiment for the first time in the history of our fMRI experiments actually exciting and fun to do. They really were mainly worried about trying to be better than other couples, but they were really engaging in this kind of improvised communication. What is nice is that we now have the time course of the person gesturing and the time course of the brain of the person guessing from the same kind of thing. So a traditional analysis would again assume that we know what matters in these stimuli and we look what brain regions have this pattern. But again, we don't really know the time course that would matter. So we forget about the timing of the stimulus. And what we do is we concentrate on these 1 minute episodes where one person is gesturing and the other one is observing. And what we try to do is we try to see whether we can find evidence that activity in the sender's brain is triggering activity in the observer's brain, which you can do with time series analysis methods like Granger causality. And if you do that, what we did was we took a seed, the motor parts of the sender's brain, that's where the gestures are being generated, and we now show you a map of all the regions in the observer then have evidence of being directly triggered by brain activity in the other region. And you find these warm colors here. And what you see is that part of them are in the same kind of motor regions that we used to see it in the center. So this is really what I've been telling you about the mirror system. The motor system of the observer internally replicates the actions of the other. What we see as well is that we have brain regions that are more cognitive that come in as well, which are normally processing the ideas of other people. And what is interesting is that if you look at these brain regions that are triggered by the activity of the other one, they don't actually, on average, increase the brain activity. So normal fMRI methods wouldn't actually detect some of them. But if you look at the relationship between the activity in the two brains, you can really see how in an improvised interaction, information really flows from one to the other. And this was the last piece of evidence I wanted to show you. And what I'd like you to take home from that is that studying complex, improvised interactions between people is, I think, our ultimate goal as social neuroscientists. That's what we're really interested in. But classical approaches don't allow you to do that, to give away the control over the stimulus. But what I think I've shown you is that by forgetting about the stimulus or your experimental control, by directly looking at how one brain locks onto the other, you can actually become scientific and quantitative about improvised social interactions. And I think that we really see in that the motor system of observers become directly recruited and lock onto what other people do. And I think that in joint interactions and improvisation, this motor perception is really key because it prepares the whole body of the observer to act in real time with the other person. And therefore, I think that the fact that our mind is not just an abstract computational machine, but really embodies what other people do, is, I think, really a key property that allows us to do wonderful things together. And I'd like to conclude by thanking all of the wonderful people that have helped the work. Valeria in particular, you'll see her replace me very soon. And these are some of the postdocs that are doing the nice brain-to-brain prediction work. And these are very good PhD students that are helping me.
All right, questions, and you'd use the mic.
Thanks for this. I assume when you talk about action scripts in the context of your multi-stage experiment, you assume some kind of high-level goal structure representation and perhaps of the various different phases and transitions. So putting this into a true improvisational context, a context like where you would need action priors for completing something specific, but where you would also envisage various different possible futures. Could you say anything about that? Would that be a different mode?
No, so I think if you take the kind of Hebbian learning model series, the one I showed you where we actually show how the synaptic weights at the transition become selected, which is this one here. What you see here is that, what you could see here, is that basically the synapse that are being reinforced here is the transition between one action and the other one. If in real life these transitions are not deterministic but probabilistic, what you'll find is that if reaching is, for instance, in 70% of the time followed by grasping and in 30% of the time by retraction, what I would expect is that these synaptic connections would be weighed accordingly, so that the one between reaching and grasping would have a weight, say, of about 0.7. The one between reaching and retracting would have a weight of, say, 0.3. And the one between reaching and an action that never follows would be about zero. So that you, what you basically have there is a probabilistic transfer probability scheme that is being represented in your brain at the synaptic level.
So all the possible goal futures are subtly represented or activated?
So probabilistically, so the most likely one will get activated more strongly. A completely impossible one will not be activated. And the ones that are intermediate would get intermediate activation. Then if what you actually observe is not what you had expected, then you get, that's the part that I skipped here, there are feedback connections in this as well that are inhibitory, which means that if you're expecting grasping to happen afterwards, then the grasping will actually inhibit grasping neurons in your visual cortex. So that if what actually happens is in line with your expectation, the next visual input is suppressed, so that you don't need then to inform your brain much about what is actually happening. If the person does something surprising that you hadn't expected, you then get, again, very strong visual activity that will kind of reset the whole process. But what's important to realize is that this is still a relatively low-level motor mode. On top of that, you have more cognitive modes, which is the fact that if you're kind of, I don't know, doing improvisation theater, where maybe in the beginning people say, okay, well, I want something about a restaurant, a wolf, and a vampire, then you basically have activated more high-level cognitive representations of these things that might guide you about guessing what will come up next, not on a motor level, but on a more semantic level. So this doesn't work in a vacuum, of course. It's embedded in more cognitive representations as well.
Thanks very much. There was a lot to take in your talk. The I wanted to ask about the reasoning behind the action perception part. So the way you illustrated it was to so we could see your hands moving and then clap and
correct.
Then we could synchronize.
Correct.
So if we played a tone and said 1 second after this tone you need to clap, probably we'd get the same effect, right? We'd be able to synchronize to the tone, I imagine, to the same degree. Would that be an issue or not? Because then there's no action perception, but there is.
So of course, I mean, if I'd be playing you, for instance, a rhythmic clapping, just on the audio channel, where you have a clap every second, you'd be very good at it. Because at that point, you can, from a purely sensory way, build up predictions of how the sequence will go. And then you can do the whole anticipation in a way that's not via embodied representation of what the other person is doing at all. So that's this is not the only mode to do that. And you can predict through other channels. I think where this really comes in is when the agent that you have in front of you is an embodied agent that is doing slightly unpredictable actions. At that moment, your way to really start to anticipate what he's doing is very much linked on body kinematics.
I guess that's the kind of force of my question, really. If we have a light,
yes,
that behaves erratically, but nonetheless, a second afterwards you must clap.
Yes.
That wouldn't be mediated by embodied perception at all.
No, I mean, if you give people 1 second to respond to a stimulus, then you don't need to, then you're not acting in what the roboticists would call real time, and then none of this is an issue.
But that's how that's how your example worked, isn't it? Because we could see.
But then it's different, because if I'd ask you to really clap along and I'd sometimes clap like this and I'd sometimes clap like this, you'd actually be able to synchronize with me. Despite all of these variations, you couldn't find any very simple static frames from which you can then do the prediction. You really need to engage into kinematic analysis. That's where those kind of systems become the only way to really solve these.
Yes, thanks for that. I love this use of fMRI. It's really exciting. My question is about the second experiment. I was wondering, I understand the limitations of the fMRI method, but if this couple could be doing this and they are observing gestures live and they have some feedback or eye contact facial information, I was wondering how you think that would change the coordination yeah. patterns that you see, what intuitions you have about that.
So this is a very good question. So when here it's still a kind of open loop, right? One person is the sender, the other one is a receiver. There's no real interaction. In some of our experiments, we have more interactions. They're more in the emotional domain. So there, for instance, you see one person get an electroshock, and we measure what happens in the observer. And what we actually see is that if we have a two-way communication channel, you see that the response of the person that gets the electroshock gets modified by how the person observing the shock reacts to it. So there we really see that closing the loop and having a two-way communication makes a huge difference. And Valeria will speak about some of these experiments later on. In these kind of scenarios, what we know as well from pragmatics in normal discussions between people is that it is very important to get signals from the receiver about when you should stop and all of that. And I think one could get very exciting interactions there. I think that analyzing them would become very challenging from the point of view that when you switch to being the sender to becoming the receiver, you would expect that the information flow gets inverted, which means that you would no longer have persons A past predicting the future of the other, but it going the other way around. So that you need models that basically calculate this information flow on a moment-by-moment basis. Problem is that these methods need a lot of data to actually start to get over the noise and see a little bit of light at the end of the tunnel. So I think although this would be what we really want to do, I think currently we would be very challenged to do that unless you would really do interactions that last, say, over an entire day, and then you can start to really take out all the transitions aligned to them and make interesting analysis there.
Cool. Thank you.
Thank you very much. It seems the research is focusing a lot on visual information. Also, the mirror neurons were discovered through the monkeys who saw somebody doing something. Then you brought in the sound, which is very interesting, the delay between vision and sound. I'm curious, what is the role of proprioception and the other senses? Because like a baby it doesn't have numbness. There is a sensation in the arm. There's the proprioception, which tells the baby, now I'm opening the hand, I'm closing
the
hand.
Absolutely, yeah.
Then underneath there are also primitive reflexes, and the baby is not able to really fine-tune the movement. So what is underlying to support this system?
So what we actually observe, and that part I went over a bit as well, is that if you look where these voxels are that are active both if you do something and when you see other people do it, you find them in motor regions, so that's the premotor and the posterior parietal region, indeed in classically visual regions like the temporal lobe, but you as well find a big chunk of them in the somatosensory system. And in particular, the most salient part is in the posterior part of the primary somatosensory cortex, which is really calculating haptics, so integrating really the sense of your own body moving together with the sensation of, say, grasping a cool bottle in your hand. And so we find that if you disrupt this part, so really the proprioceptive part, people really become less accurate at understanding the actions of other people. So and Valeria in particular has been doing a lot of work at trying to understand how the somatosensory and proprioceptive system integrates with the motor one. And we really think that what is happening is that the sensory information from which you observe the action, so vision and sound, map onto a really integrated sensory motor representation of your own actions. And that both of them are really critical to understand what is going on in the other person. Then, of course, you have cases of joint action where proprioception becomes the entry channel. So, for instance,
visually impaired people, maybe there's research.
Well, so then they have very strong auditory channels. So that is true. But so, for instance, my wife and I do a bit of tango dancing, in which you really communicate through proprioception rather than anything else. And that is a domain that hasn't been studied very well. So how people use somatosensory input to coordinate their actions with those of others. And I think that would be a fascinating topic that is though a little bit challenging sometimes to do in a scanning environment, for instance, but could certainly be done.
I have a microphone. Thank you. Okay, so I'm going to try to build up what I want to say, and mostly because there's things that I need to say, otherwise I won't sleep today. It preoccupies me a little bit that, in a way, I can see a lot of heads nodding when you talk. And I remember more or less in 2003, suddenly there came a teacher to a dance department and we had this class, and suddenly there was like, this is why we dance the way we dance, because of the mirror neurons. And suddenly we're all like, oh, thanks for explaining us, now we know. And it was really like that. And after that, everyone would just go like, yeah, this is because of the mirror neurons and things like that. And I understand that it's an experiment, but I wonder if there's a way of entering with presenting the experiment that doesn't, that gives some clues into the limited environments of the experiences and what is left out. So, for instance, you talk a lot about complexity, and I appreciate that because, in a way, complexity is left out right away. So, taking that into consideration, we cannot really start from telling this could be an explanation for a whole thing. So starting from there, then people would nod less, I guess, and start to be a little bit more, okay, what else is going on in interaction? So mostly I'm just worried about like the pervasiveness of this theory in the way we come to believe this is how things work. I truly feel it around in dance or in other disciplines where people just take this as the truth of experience. It worries me a little bit something political regarding the experiments in terms of how normative they are. So a lot of experiments have to do with a male and a female, and the situations are these performed situations. I've been with a guy for 15 years, and after 15 years, he tells me this sign when we are in the street, and I'm like, what? He's like, what does this mean? And I'm like, I don't know. Like, and he's like, fucking, we've been for 15 years, I've been telling you this means don't go there. I'm like, oh shit, I'm sorry. So what is left out when we say we learned? What about the things we never come to learn? And what about tendencies that makes us unmappable.
Yeah.
So it's just that, I guess.
Yeah, so I guess if you'll just give me another 2.5 hours, I have a couple more slides that in part speak to that. So I mean, I'm a neuroscientist, and I've been very disgusted by how the work that we do, which is looking at very simple things, is sometimes waved around in other fields as being explanations for things like dancing, for instance. Because, of course, this is not about dancing. This is about one component of what happens in you while you observe dance. It's not. It says nothing about the creative process of the dancer actually generating something that is aesthetic and appealing. All it says is something about what might happen in the observer, and only as well one aspect, which is the embodied experience of watching somebody dance. It doesn't even speak really about the more conceptual aspect of maybe you're reading in the program that this is about, I don't know, violence in Congo, and then you project a whole different cognitive level to it. So then, I really embrace your concern about taking something that is meant to specifically look at what happens in observers of movements into something that tries to explain the comprehensive processes that happen in an entire art form. I really agree with that. So one of the things, of course, that as well the piano example was meant to show is that there's a lot of things that, for instance, you are not endowed with experiences about. So, for instance, if you've never played the piano, piano music of others is not at all processed through your motor system, and you use completely different channels. And I think in a relationship, we're not identical twins that were exposed to the same stimuli for a whole life. So a lot of these sensory motor and mirrorings or transfer only work if we actually have very similar motor representations. And then they can be a valuable and slightly accurate way of entering the other person's mind. The degree to which we start to differ, they'll actually lead to misunderstandings where, for instance, for you, a certain action has a certain meaning. For the other person, in their experience, it has another meaning. And now when you get the two people together, you really get profound misunderstandings in there. So I think of it more as a heuristics of how we try to imbue the actions of others with some meaning that is only accurate to the degree to which we're similar to the other and had similar experiences. It is by no way a mean of telepathically getting into the hidden representation of the other. It's more of a trick that the brain plays with all of its limits.
Okay, so I know there's other people who had questions, and I'm sorry if we can do it during the break right now. But so thank you very much. And
thank you.